With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. A new California rule to phase out most diesel trucks in the state. California is set to phase out nearly all diesel trucks in the state over the next two decades. The California Air Resources Board has voted unanimously to approve a ban on medium and heavy-duty diesel trucks, including the big rigs that transport fresh agricultural products throughout the state. The state rule will ban the sale of new diesel trucks and buses by 2036 and require that most diesel trucks operating in the state are phased out by 2042. Diesel trucks and buses represent around 3% of vehicles registered in California. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report, and now let's get into today's show headlines. Stanislaus County is part of a larger ag crime prevention initiative. California's Rural Crime Prevention Task Force was developed to provide solutions to unique crime problems that affect citizens in rural ag areas throughout California. Stanislaus County Sheriff's Department Sergeant Brock Condon says relationships within the ag community helps the overall response to ag crime.
One of the great things about the ag crime area is that we're part of the California Rural Crime Task Force Association. And so we meet quarterly, and you know, we're getting together with supervisors and detectives from up and down the state and building relationships and networking. We're able to share things that we're seeing, trends that we're seeing. And, you know, I know that these other counties that we work with and we're familiar with, that they have the same outlook, is that we're here to build a relationship with the farmers in our community. And that even if it's just to call for a conversation or some advice, please do it. We're always available. Don't think that the situation is too small. And definitely, If you have an incident, whether it's, you know, whether you think it's small and it's just a trespassing or even just a suspicious vehicle or person in the area, please call us and let us know. You know, and I know that most of these detectives give out their numbers to everybody they meet, and just a phone call would be great, because it might just be that missing puzzle piece that we're looking for to identify one of these thieves. And even if we can't get them on this one case, at least we know who they are now and we can keep an eye on them.
To learn more about the association or to take a look at recent crime reports, visit crcptf.org. And now here's Brian German with more agriculture news.
The long process of funding improvements to California's water infrastructure is showing incremental progress. Executive Director of the California Farm Water Coalition, Mike Wade, said that while it's taken quite some time for funding to come together and be used for infrastructure updates, there is some positive momentum moving forward.
When the governor says it's been a ridiculous amount of time it's taken to get Prop 1 money out and being put to work, we know that there's a problem in the system. Fortunately, we're seeing some of that happen now. We're seeing some money available. We think Sites Reservoir is going to break ground next year. Those are the things that need to happen. The Bureau of Reclamation is getting money from two significant federal funding sources, from the Infrastructure Bill and the Inflation Reduction Act, that will bring billions of dollars into the West, into California, for new projects, for water use efficiency, water smart, for canal repairs, everything that we need to do. The money's there, the timing's there. We got to have the will to get that money working and make California a better agriculture state with more water and more storage for everybody that lives here.
New industry reports show that almond acreage in California declined for the first time in more than 25 years in 2022. Information from the U.S. Department of Agriculture indicates that acreage declined 1.2% from 2021. Another report from LandIQ also indicated a slight increase in bearing acreage over the same time period. USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service measured overall acreage at 1.63 million acres in the 2022 California Almond Acreage Report. Acreage was reported as 1.65 million in 2021. The report estimates that 1.35 million acres were bearing, while 280,000 acres were non-bearing in last year's numbers. The USDA figures support the November 2022 report from LandIQ, which projected a similar decline in overall acreage. In the recently released 2023 standing acreage initial estimate from LandIQ, figures show a modest increase of 1.7% in bearing acreage for the 2023 production year, with 1.366 million bearing acres. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, speaking at a House Agriculture Subcommittee hearing, former Ambassador Greg Dowd, who is now Vice President of Global Situational Awareness and Chief Economist at Aimpoint Research, said the future of ag trade is bright, but...
The future for U.S. ag exports is bright, assuming that supportive trade, farm, and regulatory policies are in place. Much has been accomplished over the years, which allowed U.S. ag exports last year to reach a record $196 billion. But there's more work to be done, and the strategy going forward must seek to leverage every opportunity to increase U.S. market access despite the absence of TPA. TPA would certainly be preferable and success to a successful strategy to enhance U.S. ag exports, and I agree with those who believe a bilateral trade agreements with the U.K. and Kenya should be pursued. However, there are still many important ways that we can make progress and improve market access even without TPA. I could give many examples over the years where SBS issues have been resolved via the sheer fortitude of our incredible government officials at USTR and USDA's Foreign Ag Service in coordination with the many cooperator programs that leverage farmer-paid checkoff dollars in combination with taxpayer funds. The return on investment of these funds used in combination with the FMD, MAP, and the TAS program have been without a doubt our best investment in the future of U.S. agriculture. The surest way to increase U.S. ag exports in the future is to expand upon these hugely successful programs. I also think the creation of the Undersecretary of Trade position at USDA has been a marvelous strategic decision, further elevating the importance of ag trade within USDA and the U.S. government.
So what does he say needs to happen now?
Going forward, we need other countries to understand that the U.S. is willing to make agricultural trade a priority with our relationship. We need infrastructure improvement, both domestically and in our customers' countries, such as improvement in cold chain infrastructure and technologies. We have a tremendous advantage in value-added agricultural exports, and much work is yet to be done to reach our potential in this area. To continue and expand on the excellent work that has been done by USDA and USTR in the past decade to help countries utilize and understand the critical importance of international standard-setting bodies such as CODEX, to foster the acceptance of technology and innovations in agriculture. For the past couple of years, I have worked for Aimpoint Research. We specialize in helping firms in agriculture understand what's going to happen 5, 10, 20 years out. The pace of change regarding technology in agriculture today is unbelievable and is rapidly accelerating. The challenge will be how our customers and their governments accept and adapt to these new technologies. We must not allow the recalcitrance of a few to inhibit the way forward. As I explained to my Chinese counterpart during the Phase 1 negotiations, the U.S. will never apologize for pursuing new technologies in agriculture. To be successful, this topic of technology and innovation will still fall back on the basic principles of international trade. You've got to work with your customers and have that relationship. There is a role for all of us here to play in this effort. The U.S. private sector spent $12.3 billion pursuing new innovation and technology in ag in 2021 and $10.6 billion last year. My most pressing concern, however, is getting our government and other governments around the world to approve these technologies so these innovations, which improve the environment, safety, and nutrition of the food we produce for consumers everywhere, can be commercialized. Given recent regulatory developments in Canada and South American countries, the U.S. is falling behind in this aspect. The U.S. government must expeditiously implement regulatory frameworks for new technologies that are risk proportionate and accessible to all types of entities, big and small, public and private.
That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson, Fragnet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And filling in for Randall Wiseman, I've got today's livestock report with big news on a federal level, as the Supreme Court rejected the challenge to Proposition 12. The U.S. Supreme Court rejected a challenge to California's Prop 12. It's a law that bans the sale of pork from pigs that are kept in tightly confined spaces. The justices voted 5-4 to uphold a lower court's decision to dismiss a lawsuit filed by the National Pork Producers Council, as well as the American Farm Bureau, that sought to invalidate the law. The two groups argued that the measure violated a U.S. constitutional provision called the Commerce Clause, that courts say gives the federal government the power to regulate interstate commerce, not the states themselves. Conservative Justice Neil Gorsuch, who authored the court's main opinion, says, quote, "While the Constitution addresses many weighty issues, the type of pork chops California merchants may sell is not on that list." Proposition 12 was approved by California voters back in 2018, and it bans the in-state sale of pork, veal, and eggs from animals whose confinements didn't meet space requirements. NPPC Council reacted negatively to this SCOTUS decision. Scott Hayes, NPPC president, says, quote, "We're very disappointed with the Supreme Court's opinion. Allowing state overreach will increase prices for consumers and drive small farms out of business, leading to more consolidation." NPPC is still evaluating the court's full opinion to fully understand all of the implications. "We will continue to fight for our pork farmers and American families against misguided regulations," Hayes added. On the other side, Katie Block, president and CEO of the Humane Society of the U.S., says she's delighted that the Supreme Court upheld Prop 12. She says, quote, "It's the nation's strongest farm animal welfare law, and the court made it clear that preventing animal cruelty and protecting public health are core functions of our state's government." She adds, also, HSUSA, quote, "won't stop fighting until the pork industry stops confining sows in cages so small they can't turn around." NAFB contributed to this report. Stay tuned as we'll provide you with more coverage on this topic. But for today, that's all I've got in our livestock report. This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
The top fruit choices in the U.S., that's coming up on This Land of Ours. Apples held the top spot for total fruit available for consumption in 2021 at more than 26 pounds per person after adjusting for losses. USDA's Economic Research Service's loss-adjusted food availability data adjusts the data for food spoilage, plate waste, and other losses to more closely approximate actual consumption. People in the United States consumed an average of 1.7 gallons of apple juice, roughly 9 pounds of fresh apples, and a total of 3.1 pounds of canned, dried, and frozen apples in 2021. Among the top seven consumed fruits in 2021, apples were the only fruit in which data was available for all five forms, including fresh, canned, frozen, dried, and juice. Bananas, at 13.2 pounds per person, topped the list of most popular fresh fruit, while orange juice, at 1.9 gallons, was the most popular fruit juice. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen. Recent news reports detailed a major traffic accident on an interstate in rural Illinois. The Illinois State Patrol said the cause of the crash was excessive winds blowing dirt from farm fields across the highway, leading to zero visibility. Are farmers liable for traffic accidents in these situations? I'll be back in a moment to discuss.
Kansas State University consistently ranks in the top 10 of all ag schools. 97% of K-State ag graduates are employed or furthering their education. Learn more at ag.ksu.edu.
I'll get back to the report in a moment, but I want you to know that Schrader Real Estate and Auction Company has sold farm and ranch land and farm equipment in 40 states. Learn how the Schrader family can help your family. Visit SchraderAuction.com. That's S-C-H-R-A-D-E-R Auction.com. The matter of soil erosion from farm fields has been a concern of the federal and state governments for many years. Two major agencies within the USDA have substantial soil erosion responsibilities, the NRCS and the FSA. Federal programs designed to address soil erosion were first established as a result of the 1930s Dust Bowl, and some state laws also go back that far. Beginning with the 1985 Farm Bill, to be eligible to participate in federal farm programs, a farmer had to have an approved conservation program for the farm. State provisions typically require landowners to take certain actions designed to minimize soil erosion. In Kansas, for example, county commissioners can take action to minimize soil erosion. The Iowa statute was upheld in 1979 against a constitutional challenge. But what about the liability issue? A farmer will generally not be liable for injuries or death caused from obscured visibility due to blowing dirt if the farmer is in compliance with an approved soil conservation plan for the farm or is otherwise using generally accepted good farming practices. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen.
UC Cooperative Extension will be hosting a Nichols Soil Lab Annual Field Day in Arbuckle on Thursday, May 18th. Coffee and donuts will begin at 8:30 in the morning, with the first cycle of presentations beginning at 9:20 with Orchard Advisor Franz Niederholzer providing information on spray coverage basics. Other topics of discussion include Phytophthora versus waterlogging, budget weed management in orchards, and stem water potential for orchard health and performance. Cycle 2 presentations will include an insect pest update for the current season, as well as information on hulls and shells as potassium-rich organic matter amendments. UC Riverside Professor Jim Adiskavich will finish up the presentations with information about Phytophthora management in almonds. More information on the field day is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
Thanks, Brian. And in more agriculture news, the weekly crop progress reports and the upcoming World Agricultural Supply and Demand Report from USDA are key to the crop forecast this year. Michael Clements tells us growing conditions may improve for many parts across the nation.
Friday's World Agriculture Supply and Demand Report from the Department of Agriculture will set the tone for the 2023 growing season. Barrett Nelson, AFBF economist, says the most recent crop progress reports from USDA points to positive news.
With what we're looking at now, planting progress, we're seeing actually a lot of states ahead of schedule. We see a lot of percentages that are running 5 to 10% ahead of the five-year average. The only one really lagging behind would be North Dakota. They saw a lot of cold temperatures, late snowfall that led to a lot of wet soil conditions, and rain is continuing.
While several farmers are dealing with drought, Nelson says the weather pattern should transition this year.
We've been in a triple dip back-to-back-to-back years of La Nina. Now, that typically brings the United States drier conditions. The likelihood of an El Nino event occurring has increased, which favors wetter conditions, meaning less likely to be in a drought scenario for the upcoming growing season.
He says markets leading into Friday's WASDE report reflect the weather forecast.
If we see these conditions and rain forecasts continue to show up, this is favorable for a good growing season. If we have a good growing season, you know, we may see some of these supplies with corn and soybeans create a larger crop. So it's expected to show ending stocks just towards the top of 2 billion bushels. Now, this is not a really big surprise, and grain boards have responded accordingly.
Michael Clements, Washington.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Farm employers' labor service compliance posters could save you thousands of dollars. Did you know that California lawmakers can be fined as much as $13,000 in government penalties if they don't have all the required employee and farm labor information posted for their workers? Avoid costly penalties and give yourself peace of mind knowing you are in full compliance with FELS posters. At only $175, this full set of laminated weatherproof posters eliminates the risk. Order yours at FELS.net.
Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
The grain trade now has a starting point for the 23-24 supply-demand outlook, and tight cattle supplies look to get tighter. I'm Mark Oppold with your bottom line report as we begin the second half of May, brought to you by Superior Livestock. Now that the crop report is passed and traders have the weekend to run their analytics for the 23-24 marketing year, weather and exports take over for now, and it appears lower lows are ahead in our view. December corn, longer term, will likely test the upper fours. November soybeans should hold above $12, but barely, with Brazil offering very attractive pricing to world buyers. Bottom line analysts suggest some out-of-the-money options might be in order for corn and soybeans, as Mother Nature always has the last word, and it's May 15th, not October 15th. This is the Bottom Line Report. Superior Livestock offers three ways to sell your livestock: video auctions, internet auctions, and the country page. Sell the Superior way. Learn more at SuperiorLivestock.com. Speaking of livestock, cattle weights 6 pounds less than a year ago. Cattle numbers getting tighter the second half of the year. October cattle and feeder cattle futures can add $2 to $4 longer term. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day and a profitable week ahead.
The most comprehensive set of ag-based data collected on a regular basis. USDA's Census of Agriculture.
We want to understand as much as we can about everyone involved in American agriculture. We want to hear directly from the producer because that's the most reliable place to get that information. And we really want to learn about what folks are growing, what emerging trends are out there. And the only avenue we have for that is the Census of Ag.
And data is still being collected for the 2022 census, a vital source of information for stakeholders.
Looking at February of 24 at this time, we'll release about 5 million new data points at that time.
Yet several responders and potential responders of this survey might still have questions of their own. I'm Rod Bain. Jody McDaniel and Hubert Hamer of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service join me as we look at questions about the 2022 Census of Agriculture in this edition of Agriculture USA. So many questions within the 2022 Census of Agriculture. So many questions about the 2022 Census of Ag. What is known is this important survey conducted every 5 years is the definitive set of data captured at a point in time about our nation's ag sector.
We're in the throes of the data collection activity right now, actually running a little bit behind pace of the 2017 census. There's still time to provide that information. We'll be collecting information through the end of the spring.
Hubert Hamer is with USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, the agency that oversees the census. The census survey goes to all eligible agricultural producers in our country. But is filling out and submitting the census required by law? The answer provided by Jody McDaniel of USDA NAS.
The census does have to be returned by law, and it's not just the Census of Agriculture, but there's also an economic census as well as the decennial census.
Now, there is usually a deadline set by NAS for when the census surveys can be submitted, one that tends to be flexible regarding the final cutoff date. Jody McDaniel, why is that?
We set the initial due date based on the goal of wrapping up data collection in a timely manner for analysis so that we can get that data back out as quickly as possible. And then we evaluate our returns leading up to that due date. And then we have additional follow-up mailing. That date, actually, it flows each census cycle. And again, it's dependent on the level of data we've gotten back in.
A final push is now underway to get as many producers as possible to fill out and turn in their 2022 census forms. As for the part of why some farmers and ranchers have perhaps not yet submitted their surveys, both Haber and McDaniel acknowledge various reasons. Privacy concerns about the data shared by producers is one. As Haber explains, though,
any piece of information that farmers and ranchers provide to us, it is protected by law. It cannot be shared with any other organization. It can't be shared within the Department of Agriculture. So the data that they're providing us is protected, it's safe.
Then there are the census forms themselves, which Jody McDaniel says for participants,
maybe the form's overwhelming for them,
as there are several pages of questions within the census survey.
But when you take a look on the inside of the questionnaire and you start going section from section, there are many, many sections that most producers aren't going to fill out depending on what they grow or what part of agriculture they're involved in.
To help improve response rate, census enumerators and data collectors are conducting follow-up phone calls with producers who have not yet filled out their survey.
We also have records with our field enumerators who have been trying to work at a local level as well.
Census surveys can also be completed online. As Hubert Haber explains,
we really prefer the internet version. We've made it a lot more easy to follow. And then you don't have to go through all of the sections. You can click through and put the data in that you have for your operation.
And census surveys are still being accepted by mail. The 2022 Census of Ag results are scheduled for release in February 2024. Most likely too late to be incorporated into 2023 Farm Bill discussions, development, and potential approval, according to Haber.
We won't have any information available until we roll out the results, so we won't have any preliminary information until everything is collected, analyzed, and processed on that schedule.
More details about the 2022 Census of Ag are available online at www.nass.usda.gov/agcensus. All one word. As for the how the census is developed over time and the why census data is important, that is the focus of our next edition of Agriculture USA. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
What GMO crops are grown and sold in the U.S.? Well, there's corn, like me, soybeans, canola, sugar beets, and cotton. Typically, we're ingredients in certain foods. GMO alfalfa, corn, soybeans, canola, and cotton are used as animal food. And while you won't find many GMOs in the produce section, there are versions of GMO apple, summer squash, potato, and papaya in a few markets. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
Welcome, everybody. I'm so excited to be chatting again today with Stanislaus County Farm Bureau. We have another special guest, and I, before we started recording, called him a local celebrity. Anna, I'm going to go ahead and have you introduce our guest for the day.
Yeah, thanks, Danielle, for having us on again. Hi, gang. Anna here with Stanislaus County Farm Bureau, and it is my pleasure to introduce you to Paul Winger. Paul is a third-generation grower here in Stanislaus County, former president of our local Farm Bureau, and probably most importantly, in terms of his impact on California agriculture, he is the past California Farm Bureau president. So I asked Paul to join us today in our discussion around Wage and Hour to provide some perspective on kind of how we got to where we are.
That's right. Paul, well, again, thank you for joining us. And Anna, thank you for joining me today, too. Paul, Anna gave us just a brief overview of yourself, but I'd like to get to know you a little bit more, and I'm sure our listeners would as well. So can you elaborate a bit on your connection with the ag industry and kind of your timeline of how you went from maybe just a farmer to getting involved with Farm Bureau and then leading as that role as president?
Well, graduated Cal Poly in 1979, came home, found out that right during the 80s, where we had more and more urban people wanted to have an impact on how we farm. When I came home, my dad said, you're going to farm for 5 years and not get involved on anything on the outside for 5 years. I did that. And after that, I got involved in the Young Farmer and Rancher program through the Farm Bureau. And at the same time, I was licensed with the state of California for spraying pesticides. And I saw that everybody driving down the road thought they should have something to say about what I did, how I did it, and when I did it. So I said, it's time to get involved in advocacy. And so because of my connection with Young Farmer and Ranchers, I got on our local county Farm Bureau board. And just the way timing worked out, I was able to get on the state California Farm Bureau board in 1997, was elected second vice president of California Farm Bureau, and then served as president of the California Farm Bureau from 2009 to 17.
Earlier, before we started recording, said I started with my job talking all about agriculture news, probably right when that transition happened between yourself and our current president, Jamie Johansen. So I didn't have the opportunity to chat with you back then, but I'm excited to chat with you today. Again, all about wage rates and overtime pay and ultimately how that impacts our farmers and ranchers and our consumers, actually, because, you know, when the cost of production increases, that means the cost at the grocery store is going to increase too. So let's just start off kind of with a general question. California, we have some of the highest minimum wage standards in the nation, really. California minimum wage and overtime for small employees has changed recently over the last maybe 5, 6, 7 years. So let's talk about the current standard wage rate and then those recent increases that were mandated by the state.
So, Danielle, I can give like an update as to kind of where we're at.
Absolutely.
And I think Paul is probably best suited to say how we got here.
Right.
But just for folks listening, you know, we work off of these wage and hour orders, right? These wage orders. And for the most part, agriculture falls under wage order 14 or 13. And I think that's really important for employers to pay attention to that, because that really sets the rules, right, for us being good stewards, good employers, and making sure that we're paying our folks what is legally required. So right now, minimum wage in California, regardless of where you're farming or other businesses you might have, is $15.50 an hour. And then I know in a previous podcast, we had talked about H-2A, which is a guest worker program. If you are utilizing that program currently, the AWAR, which is the amount that you have to pay if you're bringing in an H-2A employee, is $18.65 an hour.
Does that current AWAR price include housing and transportation, or is that housing and transportation fees on top of that $18?
So an employer would have to incur the $18.65 an hour in addition to meals, transportation, and housing. And then the other twist to all of this is, while we have seen this increase in minimum wage, what we have also seen is a reduction in the hours of the workday. Mm-hmm. So prior to all of this legislation that I'm sure Paul can provide some background on, you know, the ag workday was 10 hours. Mm-hmm. And what we've seen now over the course of the last 6 years or so is a reduction in that. So if you are an employer with 26 or more employees right now, a regular workday is now an 8-hour day.
Yeah, I'm sure that has to present some challenges.
Well, during harvest,
right?
Exactly.
Just real quickly,
yes.
When we're talking here about most of these bills, when they went through, they started at 26 or more employees because they said that they wanted to protect the small grower.
Right.
So there was a 5-year phase-in if you had 25 or fewer employees. And that's a misnomer. I mean, come on, we are in a statewide competition for employees. If anybody's dumb enough to think that because you have 25 less or less employees that you're going to not pay what the others are, then you've been smoking some really good stuff. And that's what happens with the folks, the 120 people. They solve their conscience by saying, we're going to protect a small grower. They've done nothing for anybody that's got one, two, three, or four employees. Hmm. You are going to pay whatever the highest wage rate is.
Right.
You have to compete, and usually you're going to be paying more.
Right.
So, and then the A word when you were talking about, for those folks that might be listening, that's the adverse effect wage rate, which is a rate that the federal government says you have to pay if you're going to use labor from outside the country that comes in under the H-2A program, that is there to make, basically try to penalize you for not hiring local people. Well, you're already going to choose to hire local people if you can find them and that they will show up every day to go to work, which H-2A folks, when you do have H-2A, they do show up every day because you're providing the housing, and they typically are pretty good employees, but people would rather hire local people if they could find them, and that after one or two days of work, they just don't show up. And so that's why they put the adverse effect wage rate into effect. Really, here in California, our wages are so high, and it's based off the minimum wage. You're already paying well above the adverse effect wage rate.
You're listening to AgNet NewsHour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Farm employers' labor service compliance posters could save you thousands of dollars. Did you know that California lawmakers can be fined as much as $13,000 in government penalties if they don't have all the required employee and farm labor information posted for their workers? Avoid costly penalties and give yourself peace of mind knowing you are in full compliance with FELS posters. At only $175, this full set of laminated weatherproof posters eliminates the risk. Order yours at FELS.net.
We're back with more of my conversation with Paul Wagner, a Modesto County almond farmer, talking all about wage rates and overtime pay.
Right. We're farmers and dairymen. You know, I constantly hear, you know, gosh, we're paying above minimum wage and we still can't get somebody to fill this job. So I'm sure that, right. I mean, that's so specific, but I'm sure that kind of goes across the board for a lot of agriculture operations. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, how we sort of got to this current $15.50 minimum wage standard. Back in 2016, there was a bill and it was voted on and we approved it for the state of California. And then every year there was an increase. And now we're here 2023. And I think it's the final year. So can you walk me through that process?
Yeah. And so it was going to stair step up over 5 years. And then you've had five more years after that if you're at 25 less employees. But we know it's pretty much it is whatever the market is. So and then it's adjusted for inflation. And because we're in highly inflationary times, instead of the original $15, it's $15.50. The other thing is it can never go back down. It can never go down. And this is what's ridiculous is, you know, again, our legislators said, well, if somebody's used to $15.50 and we have high inflation, then, you know, inflation goes down, their wages shouldn't go down. That would be like here a year ago when we saw our fuel prices getting up to $7 a gallon saying they can never go back down.
Jeez.
I mean, it's ridiculous. You have to allow things to be fluid based on what the costs are and allow people to be able to fluctuate.
Right.
The other thing is in agriculture, we are price takers. And a lot of the folks, the 120 folks that sit in those seats in Sacramento, don't understand it. Mm-hmm. I had a Democrat senator while we were there, a very good friend of agriculture, Kathleen Galgiani. And I was testifying one day and said about how we in agriculture, unless you're doing, you know, direct selling, we are price takers, not price setters. And she said, could you explain that? Mm-hmm. I don't understand that. If it costs you $100 to produce a product, you're entitled to a return on an investment. You should be able to sell it for $110. Mm-hmm. I said, no, it doesn't go that way. We produce a crop, we give it to somebody and we say, now, what are you going to pay us over the next 4 or 5, maybe even 12 months before we get paid by some for different commodities? But it's whatever the market will bear. And a lot of times we don't know what we're getting paid until well after that crop's been harvested and our expenses have been put in. A lot of the people in Sacramento think that farmers are just getting rich and whatever our costs are, we can just pass that on.
Right.
And that's certainly not the case.
Right.
So again, in 2016, we had one of the highest wage rates at $10 an hour that was anywhere So they voted to go to the $15 an hour wage rate. I can remember, you know, the federal wage rate, minimum wage is 7.25. So a lot of other states are still working off of 7.25, even though they pay their employees well above that, many of them, to have somebody that can drive a tractor or do the work they want. But the federal minimum wage rate is 7.25. Right on the heels of the wage rate increase to $15 was the moving to a 40-hour work week. Mm-hmm. Lorena Gonzalez mm-hmm. had her bill. She talked about how her parents just weren't treated correctly because they had to work 10-hour days, 60-hour work week before they got overtime. And I can remember explaining to her that there was a lot of farmers that couldn't pass that cost on because, again, we're price takers. And so that they would limit their workday to 40-hour work week, 8 hours a day. She goes, I said, a lot of farm workers will be penalized by this mm-hmm. because it's not like working at the mall where you could be working at Macy's and then for 6 or 8 hours and then go change your shirt and go to work for the Penny's or the Foot Locker. Mm-hmm. And you're still at the same mall. I said, people who work in agriculture, they might have a long ways to drive. They have to change their clothes. Most of them aren't bilingual, and so they're not going to be able to go find that second job. She says, well, then that's just tough. Hmm. They'll have to do like everybody else in the state does. And I thought that was very disingenuous for someone who aspired to become a state legislator. She's now the head of the labor union advocacy group. Because her parents came to California and worked in agriculture and were able to give her a better standard of living than they would have ever have had they remained in Mexico.
Right.
And so her parents, just like all parents, want their kids to have a better opportunity. Her parents did that. And then what she's done is she has basically eviscerated that, because one of the problems we hear today with the 40-hour work week is most farmers are adapting to a 40-hour work week. Mm-hmm. And their employees are complaining because they're not making enough money.
Right.
Oh, this could have been predicted, but yet the 120 people are in Sacramento, not only didn't they care, but they wanted to say that, oh, we're going to make people wealthier by doing this, and it's just not the case.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.